pastors here this morning, and I don't know about you, but this feels pretty heavy this morning. Oh, yeah, dismiss the kids. Yeah, if you have kids 4 to 9, they get to go with Pastor Nate this morning. So go on and get out of here. Have fun. I might join you. It's interesting because what we're talking about and everything that's gone on this morning really kind of adds, no pun intended, weight to what we're going to talk about this morning. So if you have your pew Bibles this morning, turn to page 56, I believe it is, Exodus chapter 14. And what we're going to see in the passage this morning is kind of this idea of glory, the glory of Yahweh. We're going to see it over and over again, and we're going to see that God is jealous for glory, that he wants glory, that he's going to get his glory. We see what we do in order to take away from, or at least our perception of his glory, and then what we can do to be back involved in it. And so I want to start by a definition of what glory is, and glory literally means weight, right? So that's pretty apropos for today. Glory means weight, and as I thought about this over the past week, and I just kind of thinking, it's when we talk about glory, we're talking about the full weight of God, the full weight of who he is, his essence, his character, the very nature of his existence. We're talking about all that God is and continues to be from before time began to where we're sitting in it now, to what it will be when time ceases to exist again. Glory is all that is worthy of great praise and fame and admiration and adoration and majesty and pride and resplendent beauty, the most beautiful of things. And we talk about magnificent, and I loved Erica's word in her prayer, imminence of God. What a neat word that is. And there's splendor and infinite blessing. And when we think about God, we think of all of those things, that he is the source of all of those things. He is everything. He is the ultimate. But he's also the state of absolute happiness. He's the state of complete contentment and gratification. He is the state of wonder and awe. He is the essence of the state of bliss, where no harm, no foul, no brokenness exists. You see, we see it in nature. Psalm 19:1 says that the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Have you never seen a Michigan sunset? Just the other day, just a glorious picture that God painted out there to the west. And you know, anybody who has a camera phone, which is probably just one or two of you, are taking pictures of that and posting on Facebook, right? Or have you ever been outside camping where there's no lights and you see just how many stars there are, right? Have you ever seen the thunderstorm coming and the lightning and just a sense of awe and power in all of that? The heavens declare the glory of God. And this idea of weight, when the priests would go into the temple, they couldn't go into the Holy of Holies when God's presence was there, because according to 2 Chronicles 5:14, it says, the priest could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of God. And where God exists, nothing else can exist with him. There's too much weight. There's too much God. That's what we talk about when we talk about glory. To be utterly impressed with who God is and what he does, that it drives out everything else. The problem is there's a battle going on with us as humans. You see, we tend to fear man and the situations that we find ourselves in, and it takes our attention off exactly all of God's glory. And so we fear man or our circumstances, and it reduces the visible glory of God. Now, God's glory never diminishes in one sense or iota, but yet our perception of that changes. And so when we fear, we lose our acknowledgement and understanding of the glory of God. So we come to Exodus 14. I want to give you just a very brief recap of what we've seen so far. For 400 years, the Israelites have been in Egypt. The ruler, the Pharaoh of Egypt, has forgotten what God did in Egypt so many years ago, where he actually saved the people and everybody in the land from famine. And now he's using the Israelites as slaves to do labor for them. And the people have cried out because of the injustice. God has heard them, and he has brought Moses to them to deliver them from the Egyptians, from their place of captivity and slavery. And there have been 9 plagues, each one more sincere and growing until we get to the 10th plague, and God has killed the firstborn of all that are living in Egypt, except for those who put the blood of the lamb over the doorpost. And now Pharaoh has had enough, and he says, take everything and get out of here. And the people of Egypt are giving them the clothes and jewelry and everything. And so they fled Egypt, and we come to verse 14. Remember, God is leading them with a pillar of cloud and smoke, or fire and smoke, rather. And we come to verse 14. Then Yahweh said to Moses, tell the people of Israel, turn back and encamp in front of Pi-Hahiroth, that's the word, between Migdal and the sea. In front of Baal-Zephon, you shall encamp facing it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say to the people of Israel, they are wandering in the land, the wilderness has shut them in. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all the hosts. And the Egyptians shall know that I am Yahweh. And they did so. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed toward the people. And they said, what is this we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us? So he made ready his chariot and took his army with him, and took 600 chosen chariots and all other chariots of Egypt, with officers all over all of them. And Yahweh hardened the heart of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel, while the people of Israel were going out defiantly. The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them and camped by the sea, by Pi-Hahiroth, again, that's the word, in front of Baal-Zephon. Now, what I like to do when I read Bible stories is I like to put myself in the story. So first of all, let's imagine us as the Israelites, right? We just escaped captivity. Not only were we let go, which is what we really wanted, now all the Egyptians just piled gold and silver and jewelry and things on us. So now you're in this encampment, and I got to imagine, like, you're playing cards and you're counting your gold and maybe even doing a little Ebenezer Scrooge where you jump into the pile of money, right? Like, I mean, you just made bank. Like, we just wanted to go, and you paid us to leave. Like, I'd be partying, right? And last week we saw how the people had consecrated themselves to them. They went a week with fasting, eating bread without yeast, and then they had a big party celebration, right? So they are in a pretty festive mood right now, right? But meanwhile, back in Egypt, and I want us to put ourselves in the Egyptians' position, God changes their thinking. At first, they're sullen, they're sad because their firstborns are all dead. Get those rotten Israelites out of here. And that time of mourning seems to have passed. And they're probably looking out over the land, and there's a lot of bricks that got to get made. What have we done? We just laid off our workforce and then paid them to go. Hold on a second, wait. I should go talk to my uncle, but he's dead because he was a firstborn. Or maybe I'll go plow in the yard with my son, but he's no longer here because he was a firstborn. So now you're getting mad. What have we done? And so you have both of these things going on, and Pharaoh changes his mind. He says, oh, we're going after them. And remember, Israel did leave armed. We know that from last week. But they're not fighters like these guys are fighters. In fact, the Bible very clearly states that he goes with 600 chosen chariots. Now, these are like ninja special forces armored chariots, right? Like, I mean, you take, like, a ninja, an Iron Man, and a Green Berets, put them all together, that's these 600. There's no way they stand a chance. This was a world-conquering army that Pharaoh has at his disposal. Oh, and I'll take the rest of my soldiers, too. However big that was. Going after Israel, who's loaded down with kids and animals and jewelry, and they're partying. And so Pharaoh sees what looks to be them just kind of wandering in the wilderness there. So I got to imagine there's just this bloodlust that every one of those soldiers, there's not a soldier in that army that hasn't lost a loved one. Right? Like, we fight to protect our own, but when we lose a loved one, we fight doubly hard, don't we? So Pharaoh is moved to action by the heart-hardening action of Yahweh so that he might get his glory. Don't miss that. Look at verse 10. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they feared greatly. And the people of Israel cried out to Yahweh. They said to Moses, "Is it because there are no graves in Israel that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What's the matter, Moses? Were the tombstones too full in Egypt? You couldn't just kill us there and bury us there. You had to drag us out to Egypt or outside of Egypt to kill us? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone, that we may serve Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than die in the wilderness." You see, if I put myself in the story and I'm an Israelite, I have good reason to fear, don't I? I mean, think about it. 600 ninja special forces armored chariots are coming to destroy me. And they are bent on destroying me because their loved ones are dead because of my God. And actually, he's blaming Moses. They're blaming Moses. Problem is, God has not called them to fear anyone else. No enemy, no foreign king. Fear me. We'll talk about that a little bit more. But notice what they fear instead. They fear the army coming instead. And so what I talked about in the beginning there is that fear always takes away from the glory of God. They were so focused on the enemy approaching and the dust cloud forming over the last hill there that they forgot to know the God who has already rescued them at least 10 times over. 10 times over. Right? 10 times God has demonstrated that he is glorious, that he is worthy of honor, that he is the preeminent one. He is the one who moves mountains, can vanquish kings, that has control over life and death. And they're worried about 600 soldiers. Armored clad, ninja trained, special forces. They're worried about that. You see, when you fear, it leads to grumbling. When you fear, it leads to complaining and blaming and whining and discontent and seeing your circumstances or perhaps even seeing the consequences of your sin as bigger than what God is. Isn't that what's going on here? They're seeing their circumstances and they're thinking, this is far bigger than the God who's rescued us 10 times already. And we would be so different than them, wouldn't we? No, we don't whine. We don't complain. We don't tend to look at our circumstances and go, my God's so much bigger than that. Right? We don't do that. We don't look at the consequences of our sin and we think, there's no way God could ever rescue me from that. We don't do that. We are so different than the Israelites. Now, I'm not. And I'm a grumbler and a complainer. And I was at a work a long time ago, and I was in there complaining about guys that worked. And I tend to be a perfectionist. Like, I love to do the job right, and I love to get acknowledgement for it. I'm just being honest with you. It's the way I'm wired. You want to make me smile? You give me words of affirmation, right? That's what I thrive on. And so I go to the boss and I'm complaining, like, I've done all this work and these guys just sit around and do nothing. And he says, you know what the problem is? I'm like, yeah, these guys don't work hard enough. Let's talk about it. He goes, you have a moral superiority complex. No, I don't. I'm better than that. But God used that to really help me understand that I don't believe God is glorious. I believe I need recognition. And when I don't get the recognition that I want, I start to fear because I have this innate fear of man. This is why I'm very horrible at telling people about Jesus. I'm afraid of what they'll think about me. I'm afraid I'll make a mistake. I'm afraid they won't like me anymore. I'm afraid they'll think I'm weird. And so I fear what others think rather than what my God has done, how big and preeminent he is, and so I hold back. And if somebody were to ask me, I'd be like, well, you know, I believe that Jesus is this and that and the other thing, and it's okay for you to believe what you believe, and though in the back of my mind, I really don't believe. And so my fear of man continues to take away from the glory of God because I've made it about me. And because I really don't believe God is glorious, I'll grumble, right? I'll complain about someone behind their back and to others. Quite often I will blame, not my fault, you did this. I wouldn't have responded that way if you hadn't done that, which is by no means an apology. I whine. Well, why couldn't it have gone this way? Or why didn't they recognize what I'm doing? Why aren't I getting... You understand what I'm saying, right? I'm discontent. Why can't I have that thing? It takes away from God's glory. And here's the sin behind the sin, that when we do not believe God is glorious, we fear others. And when we fear others, we're not helping them at all. We're not demonstrating what God is like. What we're saying is when we fear others is we don't believe God is glorious, we don't believe he is worthy of praise. We don't believe he is worthy of honor. We don't believe he is different than everything else out there. When we fear, we think there's some other source for honor, for admiration, for adoration, and quite often it's me. You see, when I fear, I don't believe God is the true state of happiness. I think whatever it is that I want is where I'll really find happiness. You see, I'm not really satisfied in God because I think there's something else bigger and better than he is. And then when I go find that thing and it doesn't deliver, I fear and I grumble and I complain. So what is the cure of our fear that leads to complaining, whining, and blaming? Thankfully, they tell us in the next verse there, verse 13. Moses just got blamed on. Here's what he says to the people. Fear not. Stand firm. And see the salvation of Yahweh, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. Yahweh, I am the covenant God. He will fight for you. And you have only to be silent. So let's break this down. Fear not. God's not saying, have no fear. He's saying, don't fear that enemy. That enemy ain't nothing. You want to fear something, you don't fear what can take away life. That's easy. You fear what can give life. That's real power. You fear that. It says, fear not. Stand firm. I love this. Hey, Ryan, will you stand up for me for a second? Okay. Thank you, buddy. Was he standing firm? I want you to stand firm now, right? Okay? You see the difference, though, in his stature and the way he was standing. The first time, he just stood up because I told him to. It was easy to push him down. If I had put in half the power I wanted to, he would have flown right over Lisa. standing firm has this idea that your feet are planted and you are ready. Right? It's not just walking through life casually, but you are not fearing the enemy. You are fearing the one who gives life, and you are standing firm on that, on who God is and what he has done. You want to know how to vanquish fear in your life? Stand firm on who God is. It's not haphazard. It's not an accident. It's intentional. It's being weary. Wary, not weary. Right? You want to combat fear in your life? You want to prove God is glorious? Stand on 2 feet firm and be ready. And then see. Fear not. Stand firm. See. See what Yahweh is doing. The thing that Israel should have done when they saw that dust cloud coming up over the horizon is they should have said, big deal. Who cares? Our God just did 10 incredible miracles and brought us here. There's a flipping cloud of fire or smoke in the sky. And they can't even see it. And guys, I think our Christian life is that way. God's grace and his glory is around us everywhere. And we're so busy just kind of stumbling around that we're not standing firm and we're not fearing the right thing. That we take our eyes off of being led by fire and smoke and seeing the dust cloud on the horizon. And this one always gets to me. You guys know what I'm going to say. Be silent. Shut up and listen. A few weeks ago, and I'm going to be brutally honest with you guys. I suck at this. My wife and I were talking, and I'm kind of in Pastor Don's, or not Pastor Don, former Pastor Don, sorry about that. Don Brooks's, I love his testimony this morning. It ties in so well. Because there are moments of those doubts. And I struggle, like, what is all this stuff supposed to do, and what's it supposed to mean? And maybe that shocks you for a pastor to stand up here and say that, but I just want to be honest with you, because I get to the end, and I ask my wife, I'm like, what's wrong with me? What's going on? And you know what she said to me? She goes, you're too easily distracted. I got to have the TV on all the time. When I get home, it's the first thing I flip on. And before I go to bed, it's the first thing I flip off. And then when I get to bed, it's the first thing that I flip on. And just before I go to sleep, it's the last thing that I turn off. And she's right. And guys, if you ever ask your wife to be, or anybody, to be brutally honest with you, you better be prepared for the answer. Because if I didn't believe God was more glorious, I could have got really mad at her and said, well, you never turn off the TV, and you're always playing your video games, and you're doing, and I'm no different than Israel. Am I right? Some of you are laughing because you had this argument just recently. Good, I'm not the only one. Whew. But she said, you're too easily distracted. And I got to be honest with you, I don't know if I want to change it. Because I like to be entertained. I like movies, and I like the sound, and I love my sound system, and I like my big screen TV. I'm just being honest here. And so I don't know if what I'm going to tell you, I'm even going to do for myself, so pray for me. That God would change this in me, because he's absolutely right. The way to get out of fear and to see God as more glorious is not to simply fear him rather than the enemy. It's not simply to stand firm. It's not simply to observe what God has already done. But it's to listen. Only be silent. So sometimes we're so in tune to the sound that the enemy is making. And even more so, we're so in tune to our own grumbling and complaining that we fail to see what Yahweh is doing. Verse 15. Yahweh said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward. Now you got to understand that to go forward means to go into the sea. The enemy is coming up one side. The only direction they can go is the sea. And God says it to Moses like, big duh. You have only to lift up your staff, stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry land. And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them. They're going to see this amazing miracle, and I'm going to put it in their hearts so hard that they are driven to go after you, intent on killing you. The enemy will follow. I will harden the hearts of Egyptians so they go in after them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all of his host, his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am, I am, when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen. And the angel of God, this is probably Jesus. Jesus is involved here. The angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the cloud, pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. Right? Jesus is in that cloud. Jesus is in the column of fire. Jesus is with his people. Don't miss that. He's going to come between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. And there was a cloud in the darkness, and it lit up the night without no one coming near the other all night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and Yahweh drove back the sea by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land. And the waters were divided. And here's where I don't put myself in the story. I don't put myself in the place of God, because if I'm God in this story and the Israelites were just complaining with everything I've already done when they're about halfway through the sea, oops, right? That's why you don't want me for your God. Our God is truly more infinite, more gracious, more kind, more loving, more glorious. Verse 22, and the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them. There's no way that Egyptians can flank them. There's a wall of water hedging them, protecting them, proving the way to the other side. Verse 23, the Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And in the morning, Yahweh, in the pillar of fire and cloud, looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the forces into panic, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, let us flee from before Israel, for Yahweh fights for them against us. Then the Lord said, Yahweh said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, and upon their horsemen. So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal course when the morning appeared. And as the Egyptians fled into it, Yahweh threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. And all those ninja special forces armored chariots don't stand a chance against a glorious God. Verse 28, the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the host of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea. Not one of them remained. But the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, and the waters being a wall to them on their right and to the left. Verse 30, thus Yahweh saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. See, the enemy is utterly and finally destroyed. We thought God was rescuing them through the 10 plagues. God continues to rescue them after that. And as we'll see in the future, God will again and again continue to rescue his people, kind of like in real life. A great philosopher, John Benson, said this, the Christian life is not a one and done. Right? The Christian life is not a one and done. We've got this idea in our culture that once you become saved, like everything goes smooth. Don can tell you from his testimony this morning, that ain't true. In fact, it's probably going to get harder. The difference is, who do you fear? You see, judgment has come. And God gets his glory in judgment. He gets his glory by destroying his enemies, and he gets his glory by rescuing his people. Do not miss that. Judgment happens to everyone. His enemies are destroyed, and his people are given mercy. And then finally, in verse 31, Israel saw the great power of Yahweh used against the Egyptians. So the people feared Yahweh. And they believed in the Lord and in his his servant Moses. Glory is gotten when his people fear Yahweh rather than enemies, armies, circumstances, or consequences. God gets his glory. And what I love about this is a Christmas story. It really is. I mean, you go back and we understand that Jesus is the visible glory of God. Luke 2, verse 8, very familiar reading at Christmas time, says this, "And in the same region, there were shepherds out in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And the angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were filled with great fear. And the angel said to them, 'Fear not, for behold, I bring you good news of great joy that will be for all the people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David, who is Christ the Lord. And this will be a sign to you. You will find a baby wrapped in swaddling clothes and lying in a manger.' And suddenly, there was with the angel a multitude of heavenly hosts praising God and saying, 'Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace among those of whom he is pleased.'" Part of our passage this morning says that once the waters had returned, and it looked as if they were never disturbed to begin with, there was peace. The people would have turned around and looked, and they would have saw the great sea as if nothing had happened. There was peace, because Yahweh got his glory. And because our sermon series is titled Missionary to the Nations, we are to be a people that demonstrate what God is like in his glory. Right? And so we're supposed to point to him as a source of satisfaction and splendor and eminence and all of those things. In fact, even the most mundane things were to demonstrate God's glory in that. 1 Corinthians 10:31 says this, "So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God." And so we have purpose. We do not fear the enemy. We fear the one who can give life. We stand firm. We see what God is doing. And then we be quiet so that we can glorify God in all that we do. So you are not simply a person who punches a clock at work. You are one who demonstrates glory by the way you handle yourself at work, by the way you talk about other people, by the way you treat your spouse, by the way you treat your kids, by the way you treat mom and dad, by the way you attend church. It's not without reason. There is purpose to it if you are a Christian this morning. If Jesus is your Lord and that is your confession, then you have a purpose that is greater than you. And even if you think you're great, you're not. But God is. He is glorious. And so, listen, amen. Good job. I want to close by reading Hebrews 1:1. "Long ago, at many times in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets, but in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son." Jesus is the clearest representation of the glory of God. He has appointed him to be the heir of all things through whom he also created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. If we want to know what a glorious God looks like, we look at Jesus. And he upholds the universe by the word of his power. And after making purification for our sins, he sits down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become superior to angels, as the name he has inherited is more excellent than theirs. His name is excellent. For to which of the angels did God ever say, "You are my son, today I have begotten you"? Or again, "I will be a father to him, and he shall be to me a son"? And again, when he brings the firstborn into the world, he says, "Let all the angels worship him." Of the angels, he says, he makes his angels winds and his ministers a flame of fire. But of the Son, he says, "Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. You will reign." The scepter of uprightness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness, and therefore God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions. He's also said, you, Lord, laid the foundation of the earth in the beginning, and the heavens are the work of his hands. They will perish, but you will remain. They will wear out like a garment, like a robe. You will roll them up like a garment. They will be changed, but you are the same, and your years will have no end. To which of the angels has he ever said, sit at my right hand until I make an enemy of a footstool for your heart, for your feet? That's the Jesus that we're talking about. That's the glorious God, the preeminent one, the one we get to worship in a very special way in just a couple of weeks. We have only to fear not the enemy. We stand firm in who God is and what he has done. It's not about what you do. It's not about what you have done. It's not, our feelings are real, but it's not about our feelings. It's about knowing God to be sure and true. It's seeing God at work in his salvation, looking back at what God has brought us through in the past and looking forward to what he will bring us to in the future. And it's about being silent and observing and hearing what God is telling us. I hope you find this encouraging this morning. I got to tell you, I need prayer. I'm a whiner and a complainer, and I tend to see my circumstances. And I know Brenda's right. I'm too distracted sometimes. I suspect maybe one or two of you might be in the same boat with me. The good news is we have a God that forgives. He is gracious. And we can't possibly be perfect, but his son has been. And so everything the son is that we aren't is attributed to us because of what Jesus has done on the cross. That's what makes him glorious.